Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Coleman. I represent Mr. Yepes, and with the, I believe it's Yepes, and with the court's permission, I was going to start off briefly with the voir dire issue and then move to the evidentiary issues. I'll watch the clock and attempt to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. On the voir dire issue, it's our position that there was a plain error in this case, and I think that there's not much dispute there. The real question is whether, under this court's recent decision in Lindsay, reversal is required or the appropriate remedy for that plain error.
I'm just curious, is this a normal procedure in that district court to use the process that was used in this case for peremptories, that if a party accepts the jury is constituted, that constitutes a waiver of the peremptory challenges? Is that the usual practice in this court? Do you know?
Well, the government in their response brief says that it is a common practice. I do most of my trials in the Southern District of California as opposed to the Central District, but I am aware from talking with other lawyers in the Central District that this particular judge repeatedly uses the use it or lose it policy. This wasn't a one-time situation.
That was unusual to me. When I was a district court judge, I never used that practice, so I was just curious as to whether that was something that was used.
Correct, and in the Southern District of California, we never used that, or at least none of the judges that I've appeared and tried cases in front of used that practice either. So this appears to be, I guess, a repeated practice in the Central District of California. I'd also note that in the Lindsay case, the judge offered the parties a choice as to how they wanted to do it, and the parties elected to do the use it or lose it policy. So it's something that this isn't a one-time situation.
But I'm not sure that there's anything inherently impermissible about the use of that policy. It's different, but I'm not sure there's anything inherently wrong with it.
Well, it's our position that under this court's longstanding precedent, it is error. There's a case called United States versus Turner that was decided in 1978, and it was followed again in a case called Landis and in a case called Medrano in the 1980s and 90s. So for three or four decades now, this court has held that the use it or lose it policy is erroneous.
So you think Turner specifically addresses the use it or lose it policy?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And Medrano and Landis both did as well. So it's our position that the error here was plain under longstanding precedent, and the question is whether reversal is appropriate or required. Admittedly, in the Lindsay case, this court took a different...
Now, plain error is an odd concept. It's both its ordinary term, but it's also a term of art. In order to establish plain error under the doctrine, it not only has to be obvious, which is the normal meaning of plain error, but under our plain error doctrine, it also has to result in, I forget the precise formulation, in some fairly strong miscarriage of justice. Those aren't the words, but there's that third line that I forget what the formulation is, but that's what it means. So you've got to show not only that it was an obvious error, but that it caused a genuine and deep problem.
That's correct. The first two prongs are, there are four prongs. The first two are just, is there error and is it plain? I think we've satisfied those clearly. But the next two prongs are the third prong, which is what Your Honor was mentioning. It was a substantial right affected. And then the fourth prong is, would the fairness and integrity of the proceedings be implicated?
And I'm kind of putting those two together, right? I mean, is this a really serious problem?
Yeah. Correct. And I'll kind of lump those two prongs together as well.
Okay.
And it's our position that if, in order to satisfy the third and fourth prongs, an appellant has to demonstrate that a juror was actually biased, that would essentially write out the right to a peremptory challenge. Because if a juror is actually biased, you would have a freestanding Sixth Amendment.
It would write out the right to a peremptory challenge, maybe, in circumstances where there was no objection. I mean, had there been an objection at the time, we'd have a different case.
Well, I guess let's assume for a moment there was an objection, hypothetically. I mean, under the government's position, their position is that the only way that an error can be harmful in this instance is if the juror was actually biased. Other than that, even if there was an objection, you wouldn't get reversal. And it's our position that there's no way that you can ever tell what went on in the jury room. And that's what this court had said in an in-bank decision in Anagoni, which Lindsay overruled. And our position is that to decide the third and fourth prongs, the court should just simply look at, let's take a look at the evidence. If the evidence was overwhelming, then we can comfortably say that there was no harm here, which is what a court normally does when looking at the third and fourth prongs of the plain error test, or even the normal harmless error standard. If a court says the evidence was overwhelming, this error didn't affect anything.
Why don't we look at the juror that was in play and see whether or not there was any indication that that juror would not have served as an unbiased juror?
Well, I think that if the court is going to look at the juror individually and see and look at the juror, that at the most the defendant should have to show that it's the type of juror that you would want to use a strike on. If you have to show actual bias again, then I think you're running right back into this. That's a pure Sixth Amendment claim. You wouldn't need to do the peremptory challenge claim because if a juror is actually biased, then you would have a freestanding Sixth Amendment claim.
Well, no, if there's a likelihood that this would have been a juror that would have been challenged, maybe you've made your showing. But if there's nothing about the juror that would indicate that there was a problem with the juror from the defense perspective, I don't see how there can be any prejudice shown.
Well, I'm willing to take that burden, which is to show is there something about the juror that would have caused the defense to use the strike. And we believe in this case there was. The juror was an intern, had a law degree, and had interned with the Santa Barbara District Attorney's Office. And if I was the trial counsel and I had a peremptory, that was a juror that I probably would use a peremptory on. So
she had also worked in her husband's criminal defense practice as well, so...
She did. The husband had generally an estate planning practice, but had handled a few misdemeanor DUIs, I believe, and a couple of other low-level cases she had indicated. But she had interned in the prosecutor's office, was involved in cases that involved gangs, which this case was a gang case.
No, she was not involved in cases involved. She was involved in cases involving juveniles, but no cases involving gangs.
I believe what she said was she in the juvenile department that she worked in, that there were gang-related issues that came up in those, but that wouldn't affect her ability to judge.
But she was not she specifically was asked whether she was personally involved in cases involving gang members, and she said no.
I'll take a look.
ER 164, you can check
it out. Okay, I'll look at it again. My recollection was that she said there were the juvenile proceedings, that she was involved, that there were issues involving gangs, but that it wouldn't affect her ability to decide the case. But I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong, and I'll look at that when I sit down.
Well, counsel, if the district court plainly erred in admitting Mrs. Cruz's testimony, wouldn't it be harmless error?
On that issue, Your Honor, we believe it would not be harmless error. And the reason why is that the only evidence that the government had against Mr. Yepes as far as killing the victim, Eugenio Cruz, was testimony coming from cooperating witnesses. They didn't have any physical evidence linking him to the murder at all. All they had were the word of this one specific cooperating witness and then another cooperating witness or two who supposedly corroborated him. The only, Mrs. Cruz was the only witness who could provide any type of information that was not basically, working for the government or, how to deal with the government where they would get sentencing benefits. So it's our position that the evidence in the case as to the murder itself was not overwhelming, and therefore we believe it was erroneous to admit that that statement to the mother of the victim. And it was obviously a very sympathetic situation when that witness got up and took the stand as the mother of the victim and was the very last witness in the case. That was a very, had a lot of impact for the
jury. Well, I know your position is that the evidence wasn't overwhelming, but it was certainly a tremendous amount of evidence, wasn't there?
Well, there was a tremendous, I would agree that there was significant evidence that Mr. Yepes was involved with his gang. There was a lot of evidence of that. He had the gang name tattooed on his body. I mean, there really wasn't any dispute about that. But as to the actual murder of this particular victim, there was no DNA, no fingerprints, none of the normal things that you would see in a murder case. The only evidence that the government really had was they had the star cooperating witness who said, I was there, I was in the car, and Mr. Yepes pulled out a gun and out of nowhere shot the victim in the back of the head. And then they brought in another cooperating witness who said, yeah, this guy who was in the car, he told me that that's what happened. And that was their evidence as to the murder. It's our position that, I mean, typically that's the type of case that jurors, and you look at these witnesses, I mean, it's not just the fact that they're cooperating with the government. They had long histories of criminal involvement, felony convictions, inconsistent statements. I mean, these witnesses are by no stretch credible witnesses. I mean, they have a lot of baggage with them. And when they brought in this one witness who didn't have any baggage, it really corroborated the case for him and was a sympathetic witness as well. And it was the very last witness in the case as well, which was sort of a strategy, I think, that the government successfully utilized. The other evidentiary issue that I'd like to discuss in the remaining minute or two is the issue about excluding the expert proposed expert testimony. In this case, Mr. Yepes' alternative defense was that even if the jury were to find that he was the one responsible for the murder, he didn't do it for the purpose of enhancing his status in the gang, which is what is required for a Vicar conviction. And there was lay testimony that documented Mr. Yepes' mental illnesses. He was acting in the months and years, frankly, preceding the murder in very bizarre manner. And, in fact, the proceedings in this case were delayed by many years because of his mental illness until he was rendered competent to stand trial. And the defense wanted to present an expert witness to testify about Mr. Yepes' schizophrenia and other mental health problems. And we believe that that testimony would have been relevant to show that the murder, if he was a responsible party, was not to enhance his gang status, but was just as a result of his hallucinations and otherwise schizophrenic behavior. We believe that the case law indicates, under cases like Cohen, which is a fairly recent Ninth Circuit case, that that type of testimony is relevant. The argument that it was should have been excluded under 403 because it would confuse the jury, frankly, this is, I think, fairly understandable testimony. An expert would get on the stand and testify that Mr. Yepes has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and then the defense attorney can argue that point to the jury. I don't think that is anything that is confusing or very unusual in a criminal case. I don't see how that possibly could have confused the jury and would be subject to a 403 exclusion. So it's our position for those three errors, and we also had an additional fourth error or a combination thereof that reversal is required. And if there are no other questions, I'd save the remaining time.
Why don't we hear from the government, and then you'll get a chance to respond.
May it please the Court, Neely Moradam on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, let me start first by addressing the voir dire issue raised by my adversary. It is the government's position as set forth in our papers that Lindsay absolutely forecloses that claim. And that is because Lindsay holds that a defendant must show that his substantial rights were affected. He must make a serious case of prejudice.
But that doesn't mean that there was no error, right?
It is our position that there was no error, Your Honor, and that's in light of Turner and how it's been interpreted over the 32 years that it has since it's been issued. And that's because this Court in Pimentel held that Turner was limited, that the holding was restricted to the fact that a defendant should not be unduly restricted in the exercise of his peremptory rights. And it found that the remaining language about the use it or lose it policy was simply dicta. But even if this Court finds that it was in fact error, the plain fact is that this defendant did not object to it. And this Court's recent precedent in Lindsay holds that the defendant must show prejudice. The sole claim of prejudice raised in his opening brief is that a juror served as an intern for 6 months or so over 11 years ago in the DA's office. That is despite having served for 11 years in her husband's practice that included criminal defense work. In reply, defendant raises a different claim of prejudice, and that is one about the jury as a whole. But he doesn't go beyond that to explain how this jury was in any way biased or why there was some other prejudice.
You know, I think I understand how this happened, but could you review to me precisely how we ended up with the defense not having a peremptory challenge, this person comes up, and somehow the peremptory challenges are all used up. I didn't quite understand how that happened.
Yes, Your Honor. First, the district court explained to the parties before trial began that it would be using this, quote, use it or use it policy. He then explained that policy in detail, asked both parties if they had any questions. No one had a question. No one, including the defendant, objected to that policy.
Okay. Now tell me how it worked.
Now it worked as follows, Your Honor. The government began and exercised two peremptories.
So tell us how many peremptories each side had.
Each side had the statutory allotted amount, which escapes me at the moment. I believe the defendant was entitled to 10. I don't remember right now how many the government got.
I think six, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. We exercised them. The defendant exercised 8 of his peremptories, the 2 that he waived by virtue of the passes. He only
waived
2.
But it was in the middle. It's not like he waived them. It wasn't in the middle
that
he waived. So the judge's practice was if the defense attorney accepts the jury as constituted at that particular snapshot in time, that constitutes a waiver of that peremptory challenge. So if the defense has exercised 6 peremptory challenges, then accepts the jury, that counts as the 7th peremptory challenge. Then if the government exercises a peremptory challenge and the defense comes back and does it, that's his 8th peremptory challenge. That's how it works, right? That's
correct, Your Honor. And in this case, after the government exercised its 3rd peremptory challenge, the defendant exercised his 5th. Then a replacement juror was seated and defendant for the first time accepted the panel as constituted. This is on page 8 of the government's response brief. The government then exercised its 4th peremptory challenge and a replacement juror was seated. Defendant then exercised his 7th. And then rather than exercise his 8th peremptory challenge, the defendant accepted the panel as constituted. And that's how we ended up with him having exercised.
He accepts it as constituted. Then the government exercises another peremptory challenge.
That's correct.
And then we get this person and he's, quote, used them all up, even though he's actually challenged fewer than 10 people.
Your Honor, I actually believe I misspoke. The government then exercised its 5th, defendant exercised his 9th, and then before he
exercises his 9th by saying the panel is okay with me.
He actually exercised his 9th,
Your Honor, and then he actually exercised his 10th. By
a fictional 10th as opposed to the actual 10th,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
I mean, we're just trying to understand.
Exactly. Yeah. His 8th.
He exercises 8 peremptory challenges by actually challenging the witness.
That's correct.
Or rather, the juror. But 2 of them he exercises by just saying the jury as it is now constituted is fine with me. And he said that twice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So those count as peremptories.
Yes, Your
Honor. And then when this last juror shows up, he's exercised 2 of his peremptories by saying the jury is presently constituted is fine with me. How can that possibly not be error?
Your Honor, it's not error because this is a policy that the district court laid out.
Well, just because a district judge has a policy doesn't mean that that's right.
Understood, Your Honor, but district courts, it's this circuit's precedent that they have wide discretion in determining the manner in which.
Yeah, but he just took away actually 2 peremptory challenges. I mean, in terms of each time he says the jury is fine with me, that's an accurate statement because the jurors that are up there are fine with him. Then it shows up another juror that may or may not be fine with him, and he's only said they're fine with me as with respect to the jurors that are in front of him. And he's exercised 8 actual peremptory challenges. He has 10. This strikes me as just, to use the term plain, I here mean obvious. That strikes me as just obvious error.
Your Honor, if I could just explain it perhaps in context, this would have been no different than if after he passed for the first time, let's say, the government had said, we also pass.
But that's different. That's different because then both parties are satisfied with the jury. You know, when I was a district court, I think most district court judges acknowledge that if both parties are satisfied with the jury, there is no reason to exercise any additional peremptory challenges. But if one side is satisfied and then the other side changes the composition of the jury, that's not the same thing.
Your Honor, then I'll add this. It certainly is no different than if the defendant had exercised and exhausted all of his 10 peremptory challenges and the government had challenges remaining. A replacement juror like the juror here.
You don't get the point. I mean, In your hypothetical you just given, he's actually had 10 people that he's objected to, and he has peremptories as to 10. But in this case, he has only 8 people to whom he has actually objected to.
Your Honor, certainly, again, for the reasons set forth in our brief, we don't believe it's error. We certainly don't believe it's obvious error, and I'm just arguing from the meaning of obvious.
Well, to me it's obvious. It may not be to you, and I have not consulted with my colleagues.
Understood, Your Honor. And in light of the Court's comments, let me move to why Lindsay just forecloses this argument, and that is because no prejudice has been shown. As this Court
knows. That's another question, is whether it's plain error in the sense of how bad was this? How bad were the adverse consequences? Yeah.
And nothing has been shown by the defense as to whether or not this was prejudicial. In fact, everything...
But his point is, how can he show that? Because he's not in the jury room. We don't have testimony from the jurors. We're not allowed to get testimony from the jurors. The only thing we can look at is, okay, what was the evidence presented? How strong was it? What characteristics do we have of this juror? And, you know, they kind of go either way. I think most defense lawyers probably would have challenged her peremptorily. Some wouldn't have. Doesn't look as though there's challenge for cause. So, I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Well, we're just supposed to say,
oh, it looks okay to me because I can't tell?
First of all, Your Honor, in this case, there was no for-cause challenge to this juror.
Well, there couldn't be. I mean, there wasn't for-cause. I mean, there was no cause. That's why it's so important to have the peremptory challenges.
Understood, Your Honor, but that goes to whether or not this juror was the type of person who this defendant believed would not be impartial.
Right.
She definitively told the district court she would be impartial. She would listen to the district court's
opinion. A lot of them say that, and then a lot of them then get challenged by peremptory.
And Your Honor, you know, the argument that you raise about whether or not a defendant who claims prejudice is foreclosed from actually showing it because they're not in the jury room was addressed by the Supreme Court in Rivera. And it rejected that argument that the improper seating of a juror is not amenable to harmless error analysis because it's improper to ascertain how a properly seated juror would handle that.
Trial counsel have submitted any kind of affidavit saying that he had plans to exercise a peremptory challenge against this juror. If he had had the opportunity, he would have done so. Is there anything in the record to that effect?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the time when he was about to exercise his last peremptory, he was advised this is your last peremptory. He did not at any time question that was, in fact, his last peremptory, that the district court had somehow miscalculated. He was not caught off surprise here. You know, the animating principle in Turner was the lack of notice. In that case, the defendant was essentially ambushed and left without any peremptories. Here, this was a policy of which everyone had an advance notice. No one objected to it. Everyone understood it. And the district court did precisely what it said it would do.
Is this the only judge in the Central District who does that? Is common in the Central District?
Yes. It is, Your Honor. In my experience, it's common.
Sounds like we need to write an opinion if my colleagues agree with me.
Well, I was concerned that Your Honor would take that to that logical extension. It is, in my experience, Your Honor, a practice that is common. It's certainly to my knowledge, is Judge Walter's practice, but he's not the only one. But putting that aside, Your Honors were absolutely correct in focusing on the fact that here there was no objection. And given that this is something that is done commonly
It's really difficult to object. I mean, it's really hard for attorneys to object if a judge says, here's how it's going to be. I mean, it's really tough for attorneys to say, we don't like that, because you have the judge who's getting ready to preside over the trial. You don't, I mean, it's a tough predicament for an attorney to be in. It really is.
But it is common practice throughout the district?
It is common practice throughout
the
district.
For all the district judges or most?
No, not all of the district judges. That's not the representation I'm making, and I'm not certain I can say most, but there is a sizable number of district court judges in the Central District that do employ this practice time and time again. Learned counsel could have objected. I'm the first to agree that it's hard to object, particularly through the government. But in this case, you know, this was a courtroom where everything was done in a considered manner, as evidenced by, for instance, the way the district court handled the mental health exam issue, rather the mental health testimony issue.
Do you know why the judges in the Central District elected to proceed in that manner regarding peremptory challenges?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that the concern is that one party or the other will just shore up their peremptories, and then once the jury's settled, they'll use all of them at the end.
But that's part of the game. I mean,
And, you know, I'm not here to argue that. I will just to answer Your Honor's previous question about whether or not at any point defense counsel said, wait, I wanted to object. I didn't get a chance to. That's not at all what happened here. There's
been
nothing.
Or saying that if I had had the opportunity, I would have exercised my peremptory against.
Right. That is not even a claim being made on appeal. And, in fact, at the time, the district court, once he determined that everyone had exercised their peremptory challenges, said, you know, we have no additional peremptory challenges. This will be our jury. Is there any reason why the jury should not be sworn? Certainly at that point, the defendant could have objected. At any time when he was advised throughout this process, you have no more or you're about to lose your last peremptory, he didn't.
And we're clearly in plain error territory because he didn't object. We got that.
And Lindsay forecloses it because there is no prejudice. The defendant.
That's such a valuable tool for the attorneys. It's just really, I just really find it hard to understand why a district court judge wouldn't let the full panoply of peremptories just play out. I don't understand that.
Understood, Your Honor, but let me again keep coming back to the fact that there's simply no prejudice here. No claim that this juror, in fact, was biased, just a suggestion that is not borne out by the record. No claim that the jury as a whole was biased. There's nothing in the record to suggest that this jury.
We're left with so few analytic tools to figure out how serious the error was or whether there was prejudice and so on. What's your response to the argument that we've just heard that the evidence, not that he was a gang member, that's, I think, undisputed, really.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence that, number one, he was the killer, and number two, that he did it for purposes of increasing his status in the gang. The argument on the other side is, you know, the evidence was kind of thin because, you know, you got all these self-interested people. You know, government witnesses in these circumstances, we know that, they're not the most honest people. I mean, so what's your response?
First, Your Honor, we had Gustavo Rodriguez testify to what he unwittingly witnessed that night. We had Anthony.
Yeah, but he might have lied, which was the point.
Understood. And I just want to get through it. I know I have limited time, but we had.
No, you're doing fine. I'm sorry.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have Dana De La Cuesta, who testified and said that on that night of the murder, she saw defendant there at the bar. The moment she arrived with the victim proves the defendant walked up.
She wasn't a gang member or anything.
No.
She had no
desire to testify at trial. This was somebody we had to subpoena to come in and testify. She said that when defendant saw her drive the victim up to the bar where they were all outside, the defendant walked up to the victim, put his gun to the temple, a handgun, just so the record is clear, to the temple of the victim and did a motion like this, and I'm motioning for the record that he shot.
Were you trial counsel?
I was, in fact,
trial
counsel,
Your
Honor. I was trial counsel along with a colleague of mine from the office. Then we have testimony from Anthony Asensio that he also saw the defendant there at the bar. We have testimony from a witness who lived on the street describing someone who looked like defendant running back to a car that matched the description of a car the defendant was driving that night. We also had, Your Honor, testimony from two individuals who saw defendant after the shooting who said that he came to this guy Bala's house. Bala testified, by the way, and defendant had blood all over his white shirt, the same white shirt that Dana De La Cuesta described, by the way, which at that time did not have blood on it, and the defendant was cocking a gun and saying that he was now El Señor. We submit, Your Honors, that that was, you know, ample proof that this defendant was the killer. We also presented ample proof at trial, Your Honors, that this defendant did this killing in order to depose the shot caller of the gang. This was documented in a letter-writing campaign to the Mexican Mafia leader in charge of the gang. After he received the letter from Cruz, not the victim Cruz, but Cruz, the Mexican Mafia leader at Pelican Bay, saying what he believed to be permission to kill the shot caller, he went around town showing this to everyone who was a key person in the gang, including his brothers, Rafael Yepes and Manuel Yepes. Once he did that, he was told by the representative to the Mexican Mafia leader, you do not have permission to kill. This was at two separate meetings where he was told, do not kill. And yet 2 weeks later, he killed Cruz. So there was ample evidence. And, Your Honor, just going back, one more thing before my time runs out, as to how we know that this jury got it right or that this jury made a considered judgment. This is a jury that after about, I believe, 7 days at trial, took a day and a half, but they were guided by an 8-page special verdict form that, while it's not in the excerpts, Your Honor, it's certainly in the record, that had 14 questions with multiple subparts in it. As to count three, for instance, the subparts were, did he commit narco-conspiracy? If you find that he did, let's talk about cocaine. If you find that he distributed cocaine, let's talk about the quantities. And this was a very guided process. And the jury, while they came back with guilty verdict on all five counts charged, they did not find that this defendant, for instance, manufactured cocaine base. This is a jury that was paying attention, looked at the evidence, and applied the law. And defendant has not shown anything in the record to suggest otherwise. And Rivera, in any event, has said that you cannot simply say that, you know, throw our hands up and say we can't show prejudice because we don't know what happened in the jury room. I would respectfully submit, Your Honors, that we know that this jury considered because they were guided by that special verdict form.
Did they return an NG on one count?
Not on the count, Your Honor, but as to an object of the conspiracy, which was manufacturing cocaine base, they found not guilty as to that object of the conspiracy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Coleman, response.
Thank you. Judge Rawlinson, that ER 164 that we had discussed, I don't think it's entirely clear what the prospective juror says is, we had a couple of cases where we had, you know, local gang members in trouble, but nothing that I was personally, and the court interrupts, nothing that you had personal involvement with. She says, right, just in dealing with the caseload. So I'm not sure what she meant by dealing with the caseload.
Well, there's an implication that she wasn't personally involved, but I get your point.
Right. And I'm not saying, and as the court has indicated, I'm not saying that there's any four-cause challenge here. It's just whether a peremptory would have been used. On the issue of the...
But what about the fact that trial counsel never submitted an affidavit saying, if I'd had the opportunity, I would have exercised a peremptory, I was deprived of that opportunity. What about that lack of evidence?
I agree. It's not there. And that's why I'm on plain error review.
But plain error review still, there has to be some prejudice shown. And that would have been a way to show the prejudice after the fact.
I suppose that, you know, maybe there could be a 2255 ineffective assistance of counsel claim where the lawyer were to submit an affidavit along those lines. But I agree there is no affidavit there. I think that what the court can do, though, is look at the record and look at that particular juror and say, is that the type of juror a defense attorney would use a peremptory on? It may not be on a scale of 1 to 10. It may not be a 10, a definite peremptory, but I think it's in the range of 7 to 8. I think that that's a JD degree. That's going to be the type of juror that the other jurors are going to look to with the involvement with the district attorney's office. When you're interning, that's what you're volunteering to do. That's what you really want to do.
Not necessarily. You may be just exploring.
Sometimes it's the only internship you can get, but most people try it in law school, do something that they're interested in.
I was just going to observe that I have several judicial friends who, both federal and state, court judges who have been selected for jury. And they always serve, of course, if they're selected. Most of the time, their peremptory is executed against them. But when they do serve, they have attempted to sit back and say, no, I'm not going to accept the foremanship of this jury at all. I'm just one of you. And it kind of seems to me that just by having a JD or having been involved in the legal practice doesn't exclude anybody. And common sense, when you have 12 people sitting around a table, there's a great leveler in there. And everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time. And so I don't quite buy this business of simply having any kind of a legal background or experience is going to cause a problem within the jury room.
Oh, I agree. I'm not saying it would cause a problem. And certainly lawyers, judges can sit and be excellent jurors and maybe aren't the four persons. I'm just saying that as a defense attorney and trying to figure out whether I'm going to exercise a peremptory, when I see a lawyer that's interned at a district attorney's office, or at least a JD candidate, that's the type of juror that I would use. But
that argument would have more credibility with me if he had jumped up and down and said, "Hey, wait a minute! You know, I just got cheated out of two peremptory challenges. And this juror, I feel really strongly about it. I'm really not happy with that person being on the jury and me having two peremptory challenges still on the table. If something like that had happened, maybe that argument would have more credibility. But we just don't have that.
Agreed. And that's why, I mean, that's why it's plain error. And I'm not contesting that.
It's tough.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank both. Very nice arguments on both sides. Tricky case. Thank you very much. United States versus Yepes now submitted for decision.